Well, friends, I hope you are enjoying your reading of John Milton's Paradise Lost. This is one of my favorite books, and I enjoy reading it every time I teach this class and chatting about it with students. You'll find there's a link on the website to some reading questions, and those are just kind of to help you understand or think about what you should be looking for in each section of the reading. Every 100 or 200 lines. And the reason for that is Homer and Dante we read in translation. So the English was contemporary. Obviously some of the concepts or characters or ideas, you know, were old and foreign. But the language was pretty contemporary and understandable. Well, Paradise Lost, we're reading Milton's prose, and it's, you know, he's basically a generation after Shakespeare. So the language is fairly dense for some of you. So those questions are just to kind of help you track with what you should be getting out of the reading. So what I want to do today in this lecture is kind of walk through the background of Milton's life, why he's writing Paradise Lost, how it fits into the other books we've read, and then look briefly anyway at what's going on in book one and how book one lays out some of the themes that will become, that will be developed further throughout the book. If you remember at the beginning of the semester, I asked you, what is literature for, right? And we said something about literature is to delight and teach. And we've been exploring variants of that theme in the previous two books we've read, right? For Homer, we talked about how Odysseus and other characters kind of play with the idea that what if literature is a kind of lying, or what if, in fact, it's a kind of made thing? It's a sort of something we craft out of words that reveals something about those who enjoy it, right? So it's a made thing that reveals something about us. Dante focuses on literature as being part of the mediated character of creation. It's one of those things of beauty that humans can create to guide others toward the source of all beauty and of all love, right? That's how it should be anyway. And for Milton, we'll see that he sort of focuses on this idea of literature as a kind of peaceful form of mediation. When we're tempted to find ways to force others to agree with us, literature offers a mode of peaceful persuasion. So rather than trying to coerce people to change their minds and to agree with us, and if they don't like what we like, to shout at them or silence them or take up arms against them, Milton suggests that the beauty of poetry and story might offer alternative modes of persuasion. Okay. And to get at that, I want to give you some sense of his biography and where he's coming from and his historical context. And the gist of this next section on Milton's biography should be to help you understand this, that Milton wants to show how a heavenly monarchy can be just. God is king, okay? And yet, perhaps the proper form of human government is not monarchy, but a republic. Okay, now he's not going to go as far as democracy, but on that path, right, or a republic. And this is somewhat revolutionary at Milton's time, right? The idea is that since God is a king, human societies should also be organized as monarchies. But Milton wants to flesh out God's, the nature of God's authority with great care, and show how the way in which God rules means that humans should not take on God's role ourselves, and rather we should, our human societies should be ruled by free subjects who are persuaded not by force or not by a king's compulsion, but by words, by persuasion. So there's a real political bent to Milton's ends here. Okay, so history. Milton's dates are 1608 to 1674. All right, so he lives during the first two-thirds of the 17th century. Some dates you might know, 1612, right, is when the King James Bible is written. Shakespeare is writing during the first the first two decades of this century. So when Milton's a boy, Shakespeare's writing. In 1605, Guy Fawkes has his plot to blow up Parliament. It's a sort of Catholic plot to overturn British Protestant rule. If you have seen V for Vendetta, that film, it's about this sort of event. And as a young boy, as a young man, Milton studied at Cambridge. He received his MA, and then he spent 6 years teaching himself, sort of a 6-year grad program, you might say, teaching himself theology and politics, and basically reading everything to prepare himself for what he hoped would be a career as a poet. That was his vocational direction. He wanted to be a poet. After these 6 years, he went on a European tour to sort of learn and to meet other people. He met all kinds of people, including Galileo, right? The guy who invents the telescope or uses a telescope. And then he returns to England in 1639 with a couple of poems under his belt. Lycidas is one of his first big ones. It comes out in 1637. So he returns in 1639, and the Civil War in England is brewing. Now, British politics in the 17th century are incredibly complicated, and I'm not going to try to explain them all to you. But basically, there's a sort of split between the more... there's a lot of different splits, but basically there's a sort of parliamentarians who are composed mostly of Puritans and other dissident Protestants. Okay, so you know, think about these. These are the kind of people who at the same time are coming to America, actually, right? So if you don't go to America, you join the parliamentarian camp in England. And on the other side were the crown, the sort of more conservative Anglican party, right? The high church. And Milton is clearly on the side of the Puritans and the dissident Protestants, the parliamentarians. He wants the parliamentarians to win. He wants there to be Republican government in Britain. And he begins publishing some tracts. So he sort of turns from poetry and shifts into political writing. And he starts publishing tracts. Some of these are for low church Puritan causes. He also, because of his own marital status, marital problems, publishes tracts arguing that in certain cases divorce is permissible, and this is not popular amongst anyone at the time. And then he writes what is probably his most famous prose work today, Areopagitica, in which he argues for the importance of more or less free public discourse in the pursuit of truth. And one of his famous statements in there is, "Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a free and open encounter." This text is sometimes seen now as kind of one of the first defenses of freedom of the press. And Milton doesn't actually want unrestricted freedom of the press, but he wants a more free press. Right? At the time, the crown can censor what's published, and people who violate that those boundaries can be punished, right? I mean, William Laud famously has his ears cut off, I think. For violating that rule. So Milton wants free speech, he wants Republican government, and he's willing to put his considerable skills as a writer behind this cause. In 1649, the parliamentarians, Milton's side wins. They kill Charles I, the king. This is a big deal. Milton actually writes some really important documents justifying why it's okay to kill kings, because it was kind of a big deal at the time. And then this interregnum begins, and it's a mess. Oliver Cromwell is the protectorate, but he basically becomes the sort of a new dictator, Cromwell does, and Milton grows disillusioned with his rule. He doesn't really empower the parliament. He just accrues power to himself. So Milton serves under the parliamentarian government as the Secretary for Foreign Tongues, but he becomes increasingly disenchanted with the government. Then, during this time, Milton goes completely blind. In 1652 or thereabouts, he's completely blind. And by 1660, Cromwell has died. this experiment as a British Republic has failed. And they call, you know, the heir of Charles I back and reappoint him. This is called the Restoration. They put the king back on the throne. And Milton says this is like Israel choosing a captain to go back to Egypt. Milton thinks it's a disaster. And as you might expect, the king and his party are not super happy with Milton et al. So Milton goes into hiding. He's arrested briefly. And the king publishes what's called the Acts of Oblivion, which says that everyone is forgiven. You know, we're going to sort of wipe the slate clean and go for it, except we got to kill 50 people that were really the ringleaders. And Milton's name is one of the 50. So Milton was considered to be one of the 50, you know, ringleaders of this rebellion, as it is seen now. The story is he gets spared anyway. He's not killed, obviously, because God has already punished him by making him blind. Right? So maybe, that's the story. It's not entirely clear what happens there. In 1666, there's a famous Fire of London. And then in 1667, Paradise Lost comes out in its first form. Okay, so it's kind of Milton. The way I want you to think about it is this. As a boy, as a young man, Milton envisioned himself as a great poet. And then in his middle age and prime years, he was, through various circumstances, sort of directed away from a career in poetry and gave himself up to these political and religious and theological causes. And all that came crashing down. His religious and political causes failed miserably. This is somewhat like Dante, right, who is very involved politically, and then he's exiled, and it's in exile that he has the time to write the Divine Comedy. Well, similarly, Milton is blind. He's kicked out of the court, obviously, and he has no power anymore. His side is totally lost. And he writes, he dictates Paradise Lost and his other great long poems, Paradise Regained and Samson Agonistes. So I think it's important to see Paradise Lost as in some ways arguing for a Republican form of government, right? But also a shift from politics to poetry. That politics has failed, and maybe poetry is indeed the path that he should have taken, or it's at least the path he's going to take now. So, like Dante, actually, his direct political efforts fail, and that leads him to pick up, sort of take up those same burdens in the form of poetry. Okay, so what is Paradise Lost? I mean, we've been discussing the sort of efficient causes. Why does Milton write this book? Now, let's think of the formal cause. Well, what kind of a thing does he write? It's a poem. I want to use three descriptors to describe what kind of a poem it is. It's an English biblical epic. As you all know from the midterm, an epic is a long narrative poem about national origins. And so this is a particularly English epic. Milton's not writing in Latin, which he writes in Latin quite a bit. He wants to write in English and for Englishmen, British people. And it's explicitly biblical rather than, say, Homeric. So he's going to kind of write against some of some of Virgil's themes or Homer's themes and propose biblical virtues over and against the kind of classical virtues. We'll see how that plays out. I mean, in many ways, Satan is the great classical hero. Right, but Milton's going to suggest that the classical model of heroism is actually flawed and satanic, and that there's a different model of heroism that British people need to embrace. So you know, like an epic, it begins in the middle of things, right? It begins with Satan kind of waking up in hell and like what's going on, and it's going to take us several books to figure out what has happened and why Satan's here and what's at stake. The other thing I guess I should say, and it has many other epic conventions, right? There's a tale of origins, there's divine heroes, there's catalogs, there's invocations of muses, there's elevated language, there's long speeches. Maybe the other thing I'll say about it is that it's very much a dialectical text. We talked about this a little bit with Dante's Paradiso, but it's a very dialectical approach to understanding the character of reality and reason. Okay, so we need many voices, Milton thinks, to get at the truth We can't get to the truth on our own. And we can't get to the truth just by listening to Milton, the authority, proclaim to us what the truth is. Rather, we need to learn to follow well a sort of dialectical, and by dialectical, I mean this back and forth, conversational dialogue process that begins with sort of common wisdom and then begins to question received wisdom, what everyone thinks. You know, people say this, but is that true? We can kind of question it. Think about the Socratic method, right? So dialectic is a process of critique that begins with reputable opinions and then culminates in a grasping of first principles, right? It's a way of dialoguing back and forth to clear away the false opinions and determine what truth might be, okay? So just think about this as Milton trying to teach you how to be a good Republican citizen, someone who can sift through a lot of noise in the public sphere and ask hard questions and avoid, slick temptations. I think about Satan. You know, Satan is going to be offering a lot of false answers here. And Milton wants to teach you to recognize those and avoid those and learn to listen to wise voices. So there's a lot of applicability to us today, right? Living in a democracy with a lot of information out here, how do we navigate this information-rich space and learn how to pursue wisdom? And that's what Milton's after, right? If Republican form of government, if sort of pseudo-democratic forms or proto-democratic forms of government are appropriate to Christianity, what kinds of citizens do we need to make them thrive? Okay, what's it about? What's the matter of Paradise Lost? Well, Genesis 3, the fall, and a bunch more, right? I mean, obviously, Genesis 3 is pretty short. You can read that in 5 minutes. This book is pretty long. It's going to take you more than 5 minutes. And one of the ways that Milton sort of fills out the gaps of Genesis 3 is through other biblical texts. So later on, I'll bring in Psalm 2, and we'll talk about how he reads Psalm 2 into the Battle of Heaven. But that's just one example of many, right? He's going all over. He's going to draw, sort of read the whole Bible through Genesis 3. And obviously, you might not agree with his reading. It's not always, without dispute. But his effort is to sort of fill in the gaps of Genesis 3 with other biblical texts. And it's a pretty impressive endeavor. Milton knows the Bible better than you or I ever will. Okay. And this comes, come back to this. He's blind when he's writing this. Yeah. So it's all these allusions and quotations and references to biblical texts. And of course, many classical and other texts, presumably are from his memory. So, that's humbling. what's the final end? I'm going through Aristotle's Four Causes. What's the final end of, Paradise Lost? Well, it's tricky. Let me read to you from the beginning of the first sentences of Paradise Lost, and we'll see if we can discern what his final end might be. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat, right? He's thinking about Christ here. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the secret top. So remember how Homer asks the muses to sing of the man of twists and turns. Well, Milton is asking the muse, the heavenly muse, to sing of the story of how we lost Eden and yet regained it through Christ. Of course, Milton's heavenly muse is not the classical muses, and nor is it Dante's sort of Apollo, right, of Paradiso. It's really the Spirit of God who inspired Moses and David and the other prophets, right, the Holy Spirit. Sing, heavenly muse, on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire the shepherd who first taught the chosen seed in the beginning how the heavens and the earth rose out of chaos, or of Zion Hill delight thee more. In Silo's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song. That with no middle flight intends to soar above the Ionian mount, right? Again, this is sort of like Dante in Paradiso. He wants to talk about heaven. And this is not, this is a high subject, and he needs the Holy Spirit to inspire him. while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. And chiefly thou, O Spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me. For thou knowest, thou from the first wast present, and with mighty wings outspread, dove-like satst brooding on the vast abyss, and made it pregnant. Right? He's asking for the Holy Spirit to inspire his tongue, inspire his pen. And this is the same Holy Spirit who created the world. And I think about the verses in Genesis 1, 1 and 2, right? Where the breath of God hovers over the formless, chaotic stuff before creation. This is the Spirit he's invoking. What in me is dark, illumine? I think, again, Milton is blind, right? Everything is dark to him. But there's this long trope that maybe it is the blind poet who is granted, as a compensation, greater spiritual light, greater spiritual sight. And that is what he's appealing to here, right? What in me is dark, illumine, what is low, raise, and support. That to the height of this great argument, and this is his final purpose, this is his thesis statement, if you will, I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. So Milton wants to justify God to us. He wants to help us understand how it is that God is a good God and the world is messed up. So it's sort of a kind of theodicy. But notice that his first goal is he's going to actually assert or assume or take for granted eternal providence. So he's going to take for granted that God is seeking to bring good out of all evil, that God knows what he's doing. He can see ahead. So providence means, right? And that Milton trusts this. He believes in providence even when he can't understand it. And so his goal then is that second line, and justify the ways of God to men. I'm going to assume that God knows what he's doing, and I'm going to see if I can understand that or unpack that or show that to you to make divine justice intelligible to humans. Okay? So he's not going to try to prove providence. He's going to assume providence and then try to make it intelligible to us. Why does it matter? Here's the deal for Milton. If divine justice is unintelligible, if what, and think about, we talked about some with Dante, right? In heaven, divine justice is pretty inscrutable. Why are those six souls in the sphere of the just on the eyebrow of the eagle? And why are two of them, you know, pagans, a Roman and a Trojan? This is crazy, right? This is, and we have this image of the sea, right? And we're never going to penetrate or fully plumb divine justice. And Milton agrees with that too. He's a Christian. He understands that God's ways are higher than man's ways, and we can't fully understand God. But he nonetheless thinks that if God's justice is not, at least on some level, intelligible to us, then we do not have genuine freedom. Okay. And the reason is he thinks that God, if God's justice is unintelligible, he worries that this would legitimate earthly kings. They could say, look, I don't have to explain myself to you. This is the human king speaking, Charles I to say. You don't have to understand what I'm doing. I am like God. It is just because I am king. Be quiet and do what I tell you to do. And Milton says, no, that's not how God rules. God could rule that way. He has all power. But God makes himself intelligible to humans. And therefore, he gives them freedom, right? We don't have to follow God just because he's big and strong. We follow God because we recognize and perceive his love and justice. Okay? So Milton thinks that if divine justice is intelligible, then humans should make one another, make our own versions of justice intelligible to one another, and we should test and judge and dispute those versions. And we can debate amongst us what is just to do. Right, hence Republican or even perhaps democratic forms of government. And his enemies who would think that divine justice is more obscure, less intelligible, would be more prone to think it's because God's justice is not clear to us, we need a king. We need, you know, some high authority to decide what's right and to enact it. And it's not really our place to question or try to understand if that's right or not. Okay? So that's the key link here between Milton's final purpose regarding explaining God's justice and his politics regarding the propriety of republican forms of government. Okay? I guess one last thing I should say here before I dive into to a couple of comments about book one is that I forgot to mention this in the formal part, but this is written in iambic pentameter, right? So there's 5 feet in every line, and it's like unaccented, accented. So it's like da 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 da. Okay. And it's not rhymed. This is basically what Shakespeare wrote. It's called blank verse. This is probably the most common poetic form in English poetry. And we'll talk about some of the ways that Milton uses this to good effect. But if you're interested, you can read his little... this is on page, I guess, 9. His the printer to the reader of the verse. He kind of justifies why he writes in unrhymed blank verse. Okay, so we begin with Satan, right? We show up here. He tells the muse, you know, start first with hell, the infernal serpent. William Blake famously says that Milton is of the devil's party, and without knowing it, that Satan becomes the hero. And as you read through this, I mean, Satan's a big dude. He can somehow withstand the horrors of hell. He seems like a nice, like a I shouldn't say nice, but like a powerful guy, right? And he thinks his initial speech here on line 84, page 16, makes it seem like God is in the wrong, right? That Satan is the underdog who has been wronged by the bully, the tyrant God. Let me just read parts of the speech, beginning with line 84. So Satan is looking at Beelzebub, and one of his friends, top dog demon dude, and he says, he's like, dude, you don't look so hot, right? Like, you don't look like you used to look. Things have changed, and they're not for the better. You're a lot uglier and weaker and not as nice now, okay? So this is what he says. If thou beest he, but oh, how fallen, how changed from him who in the happy realms of light clothed with transcendent brightness didst outshine myriads, though bright. If he whom mutual league, united thoughts and counsels, equal hope and hazard, and the glorious enterprise joined with me once, now misery hath joined in equal ruin. You know, we were allies in all these great feats, and now we're allies in misery, and wow, we have really been messed up. Into what pit thou seest, from what height fallen, so much the stronger proved he with his thunder. Notice again, he emphasizes God's strength. God is stronger, and that's why they lost. Until then, who knew the force of those dire arms? Yet not for those, nor what the potent victor in his rage can else inflict, do I repent or change. Though change in outward luster, that fixed mind in high disdain from sense of injured merit, that with the mightiest raised me to contend, and to the fierce contention brought along a innumerable force of spirits armed that durst dislike his reign, and me preferring his utmost power with adverse power opposing in dubious battle on the plains of heaven, and shook his throne. What, the field be lost? All is not lost. The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate and courage never to submit or yield, and what is else not to be overcome? So Satan's basic point here is, look, I may be hurt, my force may be weakened, but my mind is not weakened. And I was right, and God is wrong, and I'm gonna you know, be true to myself and follow my dreams. And look, a lot of people agreed with me that God was not a good ruler, and they joined me. They preferred me to God, and we almost won. You know, he says the battle was dubious. We almost defeated, as he says in line 124, the tyranny of heaven. So that's his sort of initial speech, right? Beelzebub's not so sure. He responds to Satan and says, well, I mean, whether he was upheld by strength or chance or fate, I don't know. What I know is it didn't go so well, right? And he worries that God has now made them slaves to work for him in hell, and he's not super excited about it. So Beelzebub is much less committed to the continued rebellion than is Satan at this point. I mean, think if Satan's right, what if God is a tyrant, and Satan is the sort of noble revolutionary who's going to overthrow this tyranny? And Beelzebub was like, yeah, well, we're kind of stuck here now, dude. And Satan's trying to encourage him to, you know, stay the course, even if it's rough. So look here on line 157. Fallen cherub. This is Satan trying to buck up Beelzebub. To be weak is miserable, doing or suffering. But of this be sure, to do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight, as being the contrary to his high will, whom we resist. If then his providence out of our evil seek to bring forth good, our labor must be to pervert that end, and out of good still to find means of evil. Okay, we'll talk about this more later as the book goes on, but this is an important chiasmus. And note this sort of, chiasmus just means inverted parallelism, okay? So Satan says, God's providence out of our evil seeks to bring good. So Satan's, our efforts, our labor must be to pervert that, and out of good still to find means of evil. So you go evil, good, good, evil. And God's efforts are going to take what we do that's evil and bring forth good. Our efforts are going to be to take God's good and bring forth evil. So Satan is setting himself literally at cross purposes to God. Okay. And this is sort of the infernal response to divine providence that Milton thinks is the sort of crucial subject of his poem. So he and Beelzebub keep talking, they sort of see, there's a lot of things I could talk about here. I mean, for instance, when he wakes up and flies away, this is like line 200, Milton compares his bulk to the Leviathan, to a whale that sailors mistake for an island and hit in the night, right? So there's this idea of deceit embedded. I mean, we talked about these epic similes in Homer especially. Note the epic similes in Milton as well. They're very thematically important. So watch all these different metaphors or similes, okay? In other words, Satan's going to make other people think that he is solid ground on which they can land. But of course, like a whale, he will deceive them. And notice that God gives Satan a lot of freedom. You know, I mean, this is, think about Dante's Satan, who is stuck in the middle of the earth, mindlessly gnawing on other traitors. Milton's Satan is a lot more noble. He has a lot more freedom, and he uses his freedom, to advance his cause. So, very different vision of Satan, right? So they go, and this is what he says, to his sort of gathered foes, sorry, to his gathered friends, right? All these other gods. So he kind of wakes up his followers, and this is his sort of, introductory speech. And notice what his argument is to them. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime? I'm on page 23, line 242. This the seat that we must change for heaven? This mournful gloom for that celestial light? And, you know, he's speaking to these people who are like, man, we made a poor choice in following you, Satan, because we lost heaven. We have this lake of fire. Whoops. And Satan says, be it so. Since he who now is sovereign can dispose and bid what shall be right, furthest from him is best, whom reason hath equaled, force hath made supreme above his equals. So Satan says, our reason equaled God's. We had as good of reason to reign, and we had as good of reasons behind the justice of our cause as God did, but force made him supreme among our equals. Jesus won simply because he was stronger, but we're equal, and we have all the just, you know, justice is on our side, and God is an unjust tyrant. He is just stronger, not just. Therefore, farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hail, horrors! Hail, infernal world, and thou profoundest hell, receive thy new possessor. one who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. That is a very famous line. This idea that Satan believes or tell, you know, part of this is Satan's preaching to his disheartened soldiers, and so he's trying to encourage them, and it's not always clear to what extent he's also deceiving himself, but he's at least trying to make them think that they can just, you can break my body, but you can't break my mind. This kind of idea. That God can stick them in hell, but he can't own their minds, and that the mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. We'll see that that's not quite true, but Satan thinks that there's sort of Gnostic denial of the reality of the body, and this idea that mind over matter, and I can conquer through my mind. Then he says later on, right, the only reason God is greater because thunder has made him greater. Okay, so better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And that's his sort of argument to his friends. So then they all sort of gather. You get this description of the varied landscape of hell. And he goes through, he names all these, all the demons that Satan has in hell with him have the same names as idols in the Old Testament. And then also some Greek gods, etc. So he's sort of lumping in all these other religions and saying these all have demonic, satanic origins. Okay, so Greek and Roman gods, ancient Canaanite gods, all derive from these satanic armies. Okay, so what do I want to say here? I'm trying to just. I don't want to bore you guys here. So he. Yeah, I think this. It's quite remarkable that Satan weeps here. In line 620, page 39. That's kind of a remarkable thing. You can kind of think about why it is that he weeps. It seems like there's a sort of theatrical effect here, right? And he sort of argues that we have to continue to fight God. We have to maintain our rebellion. And there's something noble. And I want to give Satan his due. It seems like Satan is undefeated, strong, regardless of all that happens against him, he is going to persevere. He's like a good Disney hero. This is why I think Disney heroes are terrible. But anyway, so here's what I want to say. At the end of book one, do I want to talk about the very end? I mean, there's some cool stuff with like the demons mining hell, blowing. You know, one of the first things the demons do is mine. So there's some interesting ecological themes there. But here's what I want to sort of leave you with. After the first book, we have two options regarding what we think of Satan. Okay, because Satan seems to possess all these classical virtues. He is indomitable. He's a great warrior. He's a great speech maker. He's cunning. Seems to be like either Satan is a hero and he's actually more heroic than any, Homeric hero, or human heroes aren't what they're cracked up to be. Maybe our whole understanding of heroism as derived from the classical, warrior cultures is wrong. So those who think that, Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost tend, obviously, to think the former, that Satan comes off quite well here, that God does seem to be a tyrant, that Satan is fighting a lost cause with all he has, and we should commend his bravery and courage in the face of, terrible odds. But Milton, I think, really is suggesting that perhaps our notions of heroism are wrong, and perhaps we need to rethink what it might mean to be a hero in a Christian Republican context. What does it mean to be a hero in a democratic culture where one of our primary obligations is to learn to sift competing truth claims, and figure out what's right. What does it mean to be a hero when one of our primary callings is to seek to discern the intelligibility of divine justice? All right, Satan just asserts that God is unjust. And Milton is saying, well, maybe we don't recognize the nature of his justice, but that's one of our tasks. And Satan has given up on that too easily. So these are the kinds of questions that we'll continue to pursue as we read Paradise Lost. But hopefully this sort of gives you some political and social context for this great epic, and also helps you see the ways in which you should be noticing the characterization of Satan, particularly here in the first book. Okay? Happy reading. I look forward to continuing to talk about this with you as you press on.